From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Tom DeFrank with the National Journal. Joining me on the show this week are Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C., and Jim Malone, VOA senior national correspondent. And here are the issues. As Americans continue to grapple with the aftershocks of two deadly hurricanes, the country was shattered by the worst mass killing by gun violence in history. Before the carnage stopped in Las Vegas, 58 people had been murdered and more than 500 wounded. President Trump flew to Puerto Rico, hoping to reassure critics that his administration's efforts to put the beleaguered island territory back together haven't been as robust or swift as federal recovery efforts in hurricane-battered Texas and Florida. Back in Washington, reports of bad blood and policy differences between Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and President Trump called into question whether Tillerson could survive in his post much longer. Well, it seems like this is an old story, gun violence in America. And we had, Michael, another horrible situation in Las Vegas. A man named Stephen Paddock, 64 years old, described by his girlfriend as a, quote, kind, caring, quiet man, became the worst mass murderer in American history. Investigators are beginning to piece together everything that can be known about Mr. Paddock, but the real question still is elusive, and that is why. Any clues, Michael, why this guy would do this?
No, the answer is no. There are no clues that are conclusive. There are certainly sort of snippets and random anecdotes and data. As you described, he's a person who is antisocial, apparently, by some accounts, a person who was a person of means, had created a serious amount of wealth through property and other things. It had been a gambler who spent a lot of time in casinos, was certainly familiar with the Las Vegas lifestyle, if you will. It's very interesting because, you know, I talk to people who are criminal profilers. And it's very difficult to get a profile on someone who does this sort of thing. But even with the nebulous type of formation that they have on this, he is well outside the norm in terms of what that person looks like. And as you say, kind, mild-mannered. No one ever says, well, yeah, I was expecting him to do that when you have this sort of thing. They're still looking for clues, still looking for a reason that he did this. There's obviously not going to be any good reason for doing. There's never a reason for doing like this. Just sort of a motivation, I think, is a better word.
We've talked about his gambling predilection here. He was in a 32nd floor suite at the Mandalay Bay Hotel on the Las Vegas Strip, but he wasn't paying for it because he had gambled so much that he was comped. He had a free room. It was a great vantage point in a horrible context, of course, to shoot down, to spray down. The other thing that I think is interesting is he had amassed over the last year dozens of weapons, dozens of rifles, 40 to 50, which raises the question, Jim, there is some speculation that he had help, that he must have had help logistically, and it apparently is also clear that he was stalking other venues in other cities, Chicago, other places. What else can we say about this guy and his motivation?
And the local law enforcement authorities have indicated that their, you know, clues indicate he may have wanted to try to survive this somehow, that he was going to somehow keep going. I don't know what the thinking is on that. Not only did he have these numerous semi-automatic weapons, he had this little device that's called the bump stock that allows you to fire those weapons almost as if they were automatic fire weapons. I mean, look, this is obviously it's such a tragedy nationwide. Everyone needs to take a moment to digest that. But also in terms of past mass killers, there's often some sort of indication as to what prompted them at some point. It's coming out very slowly about this man. What he seemed to be sort of a loner and, you know, self-funded and just sort of kept to himself and they said one of the reasons he liked to play these machine poker games was because he wasn't very sociable. He didn't like to deal with people very much. So I think for law enforcement, it's a big challenge, because obviously everybody wants to know why, but the information's coming out in such dribs and drabs that it may be a while, if ever.
You know, Jim and Michael, this tragedy, this horrible tragedy, resurrects, as it always does in these situations, talk about gun control. It never happens, but 13,000 Americans die every year from gunshots. But power of the National Rifle Association is quite strong, and that's why I thought it was maybe significant, Michael, that the National Rifle Association came out in support of legislation. How realistic is that, and why would the NRA, which has always been hard line on anything, no matter how mild or modest, is an infringement on the Second Amendment, why would the NRA, to the surprise of many, do this?
Well, there's a couple of things. If you go back and look sort of the history of these mass shootings in the United States, maybe the first one that sort of resonated, and I'm sure you'll remember, is the shooter at the University of Texas in the clock tower. And you had...
I was there that day, but that's another story for another time.
It certainly is. And you have a man who is a trained shooter with a weapon, raining mayhem down on people. I was in Washington, D.C., sitting in a chair that one day later... had a bullet hole in it from the Washington, D.C. sniper. It is a thing that goes on and on and on. And I think the reason that the NRA has come around on this particular issue is because politically it's untenable to support something that is capable of raining this type of horror on citizens at large. I don't think at its core that that's what the NRA is about. I really don't believe that they are in favor of mass murder.
You know, I also think, though, in this case, they'd rather focus on this device than anything further to do with actual gun control.
Exactly.
This is the... And I think you're seeing now some Republicans talking about supporting some limit on this. Republicans that normally would be very sympathetic to the NRA and would want nothing to do with any limits on guns, in a way, you could say politically it's a bit of a diversionary tactic, because they are looking at something... And that will, they hope, satisfy the public, and it will put off any further discussion of, say, limits on assault weapons, that kind of thing.
Right. Exactly. I agree with that. I mean, to use a metaphor that's probably a little poor in this circumstance, but I don't mean it to be. But this is a target of opportunity, so to speak, for the National Rifle Association. It's a palliative that gives them a chance for something that any well-meaning person would support. I mean, this, I think, was beyond the pale. So I think that's important. The real question is whether it leads to anything else in the way of gun control. And Michael, and I'm guessing the answer to that is no. I want to hear what you have to say about that. But I also think, I don't sense the Democrats are really pushing that strongly this time. And I'm suspecting that maybe it's because they have an eye on the November 2018 midterm elections. And they don't want to complicate their own prospects, because they sense that given President Trump's difficulties, they have a shot, they have a chance to reclaim the House. So do you think there's anything that will happen beyond the bump stock?
Well, something needs to happen for sure. I think, as you rightly point out, Jim, that this is about controlling a gun rather than gun control. It's putting a limit on a particular function of a particular type of weapon, but not really on the amount of guns. It's not about background checks. It's not about really limiting access to weapons overall. And again, the NRA's policy is that anything in that direction is a thin edge of the wedge that could take every gun out of every American's hands, which would be quite something, since there are about 300 million guns in this country.
There are almost as many guns in the United States as there are people.
By my estimate, there are more. There are 112 guns for every 100 people. So that's my research. Look, I think that the Democrats may be going a little bit soft on this issue right now, but I think it depends on which wing of the Democratic Party that you're looking at right now, because we do have sort of this fracture between the all-out liberals who are going towards their base and others who are sort of the more traditional conservatives, the Pelosi base, are saying, like, let's just take a minute and step back.
And I think the Democrats want to focus on the economy, on being the counterpoint to Trump as they get ready for other elections. You could argue that to start a whole debate on guns would be a political distraction from that,
right,
which may not exactly play into their plans. And the other thing that, and it's a very painful moment in our history, but to recall the 2012 massacre at the elementary school in Connecticut.
Newtown.
If ever there was a time that you would have thought that the country would come together and be able to be rallied to do something, it was that. And I think even on the Democratic side, once they saw that that was not going to go anywhere, you know, it just sort of, you know, made it concrete that the gun issue is very polarizing, very divisive, and particularly with Republicans controlling Congress, it seems unlikely to see much in the way of real reform or action.
Right. As a political reality, there are many Americans who are honorable and honest and decent and hardworking who are opposed to gun control. But their opposition is so intense that for many Americans, they are single-issue voters. And if you, as a congressman, don't agree with that, hundreds of thousands of these voters will vote against you only for that reason. So it's very tricky political. I have to say, I thought it was quite ironic that in a moment of this great tragedy, two Republican members of Congress are pushing a bill through Congress to make it easier for Americans to own silencers on the grounds that the silencers would help the ears of hunters. So if you're always looking for irony, you'll always be able to find some. We'll have more in just a minute. You're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor of the National Journal. And joining me today are Michael Williams, CBS radio contributor, and Jim Malone, VOA senior national correspondent. This is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Listen to it and then tell us what you think by taking a short survey on our Facebook page. Just look for Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panelists. Well, of course, President Trump flew off to Las Vegas and to do what is required of all presidents in times of national crisis and tragedy like this. He was the comforter-in-chief, and most people think he did a very good job of that. But he also flew to Puerto Rico to convince hundreds of thousands of residents of Puerto Rico that the federal government was doing everything they could. Unlike the federal government's response in Houston and Miami and Texas and Florida for the damage from Hurricane Harvey and Hurricane Irma, there have been critics of the administration's response in Puerto Rico, notably the mayor of San Juan, who got into a real back and forth with President Trump, who accused her of being very supportive until Democrats said she had to break with the government and criticize Trump for political reasons. We're not going to go into all of that. But, Michael, what is the state of the recovery efforts in Puerto Rico? We hear these horror stories that 10 days later, 2 weeks later, needed supplies, food and water are still not being distributed everywhere, and that electricity may be off for months in portions of Puerto Rico.
Well, these estimates and assessments are still valid. There is no change in the fact that most of the island is probably not going to have power for months. I think the last estimate was that 6% of the island had power and light restored. The logistical challenges are staggering, because especially when you talk about distribution, where you can't get to roads, where you talk about providing food and water and medications when there is no power, and then you can only have non-perishable foods. Now, what about milk? What about, you know, dairy products? What about it's staggering, the things that they're having to face. And I do think that FEMA, given this hurricane season, is stretched absolutely to the limit, you know, with their resources, and I'm sure that they can do the best that they can. Having said that, I think that the way the president presented himself and the government and made a case for the fact that there should be praise for the effort sounded kind of an off note. It really did. The meeting where he met with officials and you had sort of this call and response of praise and compliments that sort of reminded me of that infamous cabinet meeting where people went around, and I think Reince Priebus even said he was blessed to be serving for the president. And I think that is the currency of the realm for President Trump. He understands that. And as long as you explain, as long as you understand that you need to compliment us, you need to support us in that way verbally, we'll still try to do our best. The minute you criticize, you are on the Twitter list. And especially, I believe, personally, if you are a woman. He does not receive criticism from women well. And Mayor Cruz was extremely critical of the effort and of the presentation.
Biographers of President Trump have written many times that critical to his psyche is the need for respect and reaffirmation. And that it's important to him, and it's always been important to him, and to his ego and to his persona. Is it possible in this case, Jim, that that personality component has gotten in the way here in Puerto Rico?
It seems as though it was evident, and maybe it's good tease for the next segment where we talk about Rex Tillerson. But yeah, a couple of enduring images from his visit there. The most enduring to me is him pitching paper towels at a crowd. That was struck people as a little odd.
And then not a great visual.
Yeah, meeting with some of the residents affected, I guess in one of the nicer areas there, and then telling them to have a nice day. But, you know, here's the other thing. They are American citizens. And what if this had happened somewhere on the American mainland?
Well, it did happen. It did happen on the American mainland.
Yes,
and the response you could argue was.
What if the enduring devastation had happened, where you have some area of some state couldn't have power for 2 weeks? I mean, what would be the reaction then? So, part of this is about the dynamic of where Puerto Rico fits into our national psyche, I suppose. But yeah, you get this essential Trump on these things. You don't know what you're going to get, but it did seem to be heavily focused on he likes to grade himself, but he really likes people to be praising him in public when he's there in front of others and, of course, in front of the cameras. So we didn't see that with the Las Vegas component, which, you know, presidents do have this traditional role as comforter-in-chief, consoler-in-chief, and he stepped up to the plate on that one. But with the, and now I see Vice President Pence is making a further effort there. So maybe that suggests they know they have a bit more work to do, not just in terms of relief, but in terms of public relations.
Well, I think Vice President Pence is doing a lot of work, follow-up work, going to Puerto Rico and also the Virgin Islands, the U.S. Virgin Islands, which were heavily damaged as well. So the message is we're going to be here for you for as long as it takes, and hopefully that any criticism gets washed out in the ongoing recovery effort by the White House, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, and the government in general. You can be sure that there are going to be billions of dollars in storm relief to Texas and Florida and the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, and the budget deficit will not matter, because this will be important. Now, you mentioned our next segment, Jim, and it's really a kind of amazing to me. There are about Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. There have been reports filtering out of the White House for months. Whispering that the Secretary of State and the President of the United States were, to put it charitably, frustrated with one another. They seem to have whatever else they are dealing with. They have personality differences. These are two very strong former chief executive officers used to running the show. And they seem not to have clicked personally. They seem not to have developed any kind of a real personal relationship. And now it's taken a more visible turn. We'll get to the policy differences in just a minute. But Michael, I must say, it's been a long time since I have watched a press conference in this town where a cabinet officer had to try to establish his bona fides and to say that he didn't describe the president of the United States, his boss, in unflattering terms.
Yeah, it's as you say, it's an ongoing, long term sort of slow motion car crash, you know, that we've been seeing between, you know, these two personalities. Look, Rex Tillerson and Donald Trump did not know each other. before this. This wasn't like the president nominated a good, close, long-term personal aide. This was somebody who was recommended by people like James Baker and Condi Rice, who had experience and knowledge and an appreciation for Rex Tillerson's skills through their workings in the oil industry. He was taken on good faith. Rex Tillerson, I think, has performed as best as he can as a person, again, with no experience as a diplomat, no real experience in government. He's tried to do his best. It's very difficult, though, to stay on the right side of Donald Trump, I believe, unless you are a long-term aide or a family member. I mean, has anyone really cracked that code on how you stay on the good side of him? Look at the list of top-level officials who have left that White House. It's staggering. It's only been 9 months.
You know, Jim, it's interesting. Michael mentioned James Baker and Condoleezza Rice, former Republican Secretaries of State. Former CIA Director and Secretary of Defense Bob Gates was a big fan of Rex Tillerson, too. So he came highly recommended. And I'm guessing that now that Tillerson and President Trump's view has not worked out, is probably yet another indication of how Trump believes that the establishment has failed him. But I mean, setting aside the personality conflicts, and there are many. There are clearly some serious foreign policy differences. I'll mention in passing. Iran. The word in Washington is that President Trump is poised to decertify the nuclear arms deal with Iran, not imposing sanctions, but kicking it to Congress on the grounds that this was a treaty, and President Obama didn't send it to the Senate because he knew he couldn't get it passed there. But it's the Congress now has to deal with it, and it's well known that Secretary Tillerson has argued that the Iran deal has many flaws, but on balance, it's in the national interest. So this is not has not endeared him with President Trump. Talk a little bit about some of their other conflicts on places like North Korea and Afghanistan and Qatar and the United Arab Emirates.
It was only a few days ago that the president seemed to undercut Secretary Tillerson with a tweet about him negotiating with the Chinese over North Korea. Basically, you know, save your time. You know, it's not worth it. Which sort of revealed the underlying tensions there between the two. And, you know, we talked about the president's role as comforter-in-chief, but he's never wanted to relinquish the role of campaigner-in-chief. He has continued to run it as a political campaign right into the White House.
So the real question for all of us here is, given these dynamics, can Rex Tillerson survive? I mean, there's a lot of buzz in Washington that now he will have to leave, and they're now looking for a decent interval. I mean, I get a feeling that there's more than a few members of this administration who are looking for next January 20th to be able to say, I promised the president I would come in for a year. So I would be shocked if Tillerson is still on the job next March the 1st.
I mean, Michael? I think he tried to... Tillerson was praising Trump publicly. That was obviously an attempt, I think, to kind of patch it up a bit. But if you look at the record of people who have crossed or criticized the president in the past, it's not good in terms of their political longevity.
Michael, what's your take on that?
Well, I think if you listen closely, you can hear the faint ticking that is the countdown clock on Rex Tillerson. And many people had suggested that the entire United Nations General Assembly meeting was sort of an audition for Nikki Haley as potential Secretary of State. I agree with that assessment. Other reports now that Mike Pompeo is being fitted out for that job.
CIA Director
Mike Pompeo, yes.
Well, apparently the president very much likes, sees a lot of, and I actually think he could be a strong contender.
Yeah.
Well, that's all the time we have. Thank you to Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor, and to Jim Malone, the VOA senior national correspondent. Always a pleasure to have you join us, Jim. This program was produced by Rebecca Ward. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. And I'm Tom DeFrank, contributing editor for National Journal. Thanks for listening.